So today, before this lecture started, there were enormous problems. We had to deal with technical things, many things broken that we had to fix. And that's exactly how my previous week went, every single day. We have a place down the road where it's called, the title of the person's shop is, "You Break, I Fix." And that's basically what happened with my life. It's been a very interesting experience. Things break, you have to fix them. Bodies break, you've got to fix it. Especially as you get older. My uncle just became 97. We had lunch with him on his birthday. It was wild. 97 years old, and my mother is 96. I mean, I'm struggling, and they got like 21, 22 years on me. So I'm thinking like, oh my God, how am I gonna make it? So my whole week has been so confused because all I'm doing is like horses. We have one horse here who's in really bad shape. And the cat outside is becoming crazy, needs so much attention. Like when you walk outside, grabs you on the leg and doesn't let you go. And you're like, what do you want? Speak to me, speak to me. And the cat says, yes. Do you want food? Do you want water? Do you want to get petted? What do you need? And the birds are like, they're saying, feed us. And the tomato plants have aphids on them. These are little white bugs in Florida. So everywhere you look, and there's no rain. Every single day, the weather report says it's gonna rain like mad. And it never rains. So I'm like wondering, you know, Kamamala asked me in the middle of the week about a lecture. So ever since, whenever he asks, it's like, what am I going to talk about? Whenever I get that email, my first inclination is to say, no, I'm busy. No, I'm not busy. He knows I'm not doing that. He knows Saturday is chalked off. He knows. But I want to say, busy, sorry, no way, can't do it. Because I have no idea what to say. And when you have no idea what to say, you get scared. I'm afraid. I'm going to come here, sit in front of you, and have nothing to say. So it's great that I can fight with technology. Because if it's me against technology, usually I win. So I'm very happy with that. I can live with that. But lecturing? I have to come up with something. So this morning, I wrote to my go-to people, those special people you don't know about, what should I talk about? And I got some things to talk about, and of them, one of them caught my attention. What is the role of Shastra in spiritual development? Now, I don't talk about this stuff. I avoid it. So this morning, you know, Kamala, I ask her, this is a good topic. So what should I talk about? So she says, well, you know, I like to hear. I like to learn by hearing. I wasn't so much into like reading books. And then she went through this whole list of people who would not be normally attuned to reading and studying books about spirituality. You know, she's a psychotherapist, got all kinds of degrees, all kinds of papers on the walls, certifications. She deals with all kinds of people all the time. So she started listing off people who would not benefit or would not function well in a kind of a environment in which, you know, they would have to read books and make sense of it. So I said, ding, good point. Well, was in the Vedic society, you know, we use the word loosely, I don't want to get involved in though it's not the right word, but in the Vedic, quote unquote, society, the books, well, first of all, they didn't exist. It wasn't until Vyasadeva that they were written down. So that means in its natural form, everything took place by speaking and hearing. Now, what's good about speaking and hearing is that the speaker can adjust what they're saying according to the listener. And the problem with it being written down is the book is fixed. It's no longer adjusted to the listener. Every reader gets the same thing. But every reader accepts it in a unique manner. So Shastra now becomes, in this modern environment, we're talking within who knows how many thousands of years, whatever, we can't figure out the time scale, that's not important. There are three things now that are important. There's like the Shastra, then there are like gurus and sadhus. So like kind of three elements work together to somehow get that knowledge across. So now you have the basis, the fundamental basis of thought and teachings in the literatures, which are written down, and you have two other sources which can interpret that and deliver that according to the audience. So far, all good. Everything's standard. Everything makes sense. No, nothing new in any of this. It's all, you know, of course, the way it is. So I started thinking about how I, me personally, because I usually like to talk, I only like to speak from my experience. I don't like to speak by quoting Shastra. I don't like to repeat things which were told to me. But I will do it when those things are things that I have personally experienced. So therefore, what I am saying is, in my mind at least, verified. So I can speak from conviction. And if I'm challenged to describe it, I can do so. I don't remember, but probably I mentioned last week or the week before about Richard Feynman. He said, if you can't explain something simply, you don't understand it. He's a super famous physicist, in case you don't know. So I embrace that ideal. So in my mind at least, I'm going somewhere with this, so hang in there. In my mind at least, I have no problem speaking fundamental, spiritual, essential truths to any audience. Because what I'm saying is derived from within, and therefore, I don't have to struggle to find it related to something in a Shastra. Now, that also means I'm not going to talk about things which are not within my experience, but which are within the Shastra. But I'm very well aware that those things will find somebody else who does embrace them and will be able to speak about them. So the conclusion from this is the Shastra is a big thing where everybody can find a place. But it focuses us towards a certain point. Now, this is another aspect of the Shastra which I really loved. If you look at, for example, Srimad Bhagavatam, it was spoken by Shukadev Goswami to Maharaj Parikshit. And it goes through a large variety of subject matters. Many things are described. Descriptions of the cosmos, descriptions of time. Like Carl Sagan said that famous astronomer, gone for a while now, said that only the Vedic literature can even approach the timescales required to understand the universe and even go beyond those timescales. So you've got descriptions that are from other planets, other times, other dimensional spaces, things that you might not believe at all, things that you would love to believe, things that you find very troublesome and sometimes very comforting. So you get this wonderful presentation that includes everything for everybody. Now, what I think is very interesting is Shukadev Goswami's place within this. So he's going through all of these descriptions, and then he comes into the 10th canto. And then within the 10th canto, he starts to speak about Krishna and the gopis and all of the very amazing pastimes there. Now, I don't have personal experience of this because I don't understand it in the same way, but Hridayananda Maharaj once explained it to me. So he really got into Sanskrit, learned Sanskrit very well. And he said, you cannot imagine the sophisticated, beautiful, exquisite poetry and imagery with it that Sukadeva Goswami uses to describe these pastimes. He was speaking from experience and connecting completely with that energy of that experience of Gokula Vrindavan and just expressing exactly from that platform. Sukadeva Goswami. Now, here we start to understand one of the difficulties we have in our present system. When Shukadeva was speaking this to Maharaj Parikshit, the entire audience, everyone, was living within that same energy. Because the sound vibration, the presentation by using that sound and words and imagery and the way the sounds were just related to each other in such a rhythm, in such a pattern, everybody's consciousness was there. It was as if Shukadev took Maharaj Parikshit from his situation of the remnants of the Battle of Kurukshetra and how he was going to be killed there by that Brahmastra weapon and then bringing him all the way to the spiritual realm. Now that experience of the Shastra, we cannot imagine. And a translation of it, which then appears in writing, does not do the same thing. The media within which the message is transformed transforms the entire experience, even if you were to translate perfectly, which is almost impossible. You would not be able to capture that experience as it was given at that time or enter into that location when it was being spoken. It's even one thing to read about an event and quite another to be in the event. So now we have these other two ingredients. We have sadhus and gurus who are supposed to assist us to carry over that lacking and bring it to us in a very realized fashion. So now we have another situation. We have people attempting, and that's a very important word, attempting to convey that message as it was given. Prabhupada understood that when he was translating the Bhagavad Gita, the responsibility there. He understood that and said, as it is, trying to give it to you just as it was given. But the reality of the situation, not a defect in the presentation, but the reality of the situation is you cannot give it as it is. You can give the best attempt to translate what it was. And again, you're taking something that was written down from something that was heard. So the importance of these other two elements becomes very, very significantly obvious. Now, if the people presenting the message understand the message, they can give the message. It's not just a question of repeating it. It's not even just a question of being really good at repeating it or being very loyal in your repetition. Now it's something completely new. Having absorbed all of it, having come to that realization and experience expressing it, that becomes something in and of itself, separate and unique and individual. Now, I think the implications of this are very deep. And because of that, I've had difficulties with the term guru or sadhu. Because if I were to place the prerequisite requirements for entering into such a designation, I would put it beyond the designation into some unique personal experience. That's a contradiction. You're stuck. Did you get it? Well, see, you just did it. You just took it and made it something what you could say. So, Maha, honestly speaking now, don't mess. Did you believe it? What I said, what you translated. Oh, okay. Just checking. So, now we have this situation that were we to use these terminologies to define the speakers or presenters, it would diminish the presentation in some manner. Well, this is a problem. First of all, very few people are going to accept what I just said. Because when somebody accepts somebody as guru, they accept, and there's no question of the limitation thing entering into it. So I have to explain this further. I don't like the word guru. You know that. Now a sadhu. Let's go to sadhu. What is a sadhu? Ask anybody and they'll say saintly personality. Standard definition. Again, problems with that. How do these things actually manifest in reality? If there are restrictions, a sadhu acts like this, a guru acts like this, they do these things, this is their category, this is their manner of action, speaking, and representation. From down here's point of view, you know, when you're looking up at this thing, that's not a problem. That's a security. There's standard stuff here. We feel good about it. But from that point of view, what does it mean? I have to be like that. I am restricted. Someone else may say, well, that's not a problem. That's a good restriction. Is it? We started off this lecture talking about the unique experience we have. What if the unique experience would have led one to another place? How does that fit in within this triumvirate of sadhu, shastra, and guru? It doesn't. So, is it that everything I said before about coming to the unique experience of these things and explaining specifically from one's experience, does that mean it is invalid? Well, it depends on who you are. If you're living in this safety and security and you feel good about it and you think this is right, yes, it creates an invalid situation because it no longer fits. If you don't, well, then it makes sense. Now, just for a short time, I'm going to talk about me. I'm sorry, you'll get bored. Don't worry about it. It'll be over soon. I don't like fitting within that triangle. It's not a triangle, I know. I've made a geometric form out of something that's much bigger. I'm sorry. I don't fit within that structure, that pattern. At one point, I understood it does not work for me. And to find me became more important than fitting in. So now I'm sharing my me with you through sound. I do not want you to be like fill in the blank, anything. There's no expectation for you. That's very important. I don't expect you to be anything. I don't demand you to be anything. I want you to be happy. I want you to gain realization. I want you to have this feeling and embrace Radha and Krishna and love and the divine energy. I want that for you. I don't care how you get that.
I couldn't find how you get.
I want you to get and be happy in whatever way you can. I don't demand that you do it in a certain way. That's absurd for me to make a demand of you. What would I demand anyway, and why? I want you to be the best you can be exactly, not exactly, but anyway, like Sukadev Goswami wanted Maharaj Parikshit to be the best he could be at the time of death. So if sadhu, shastra, and guru works perfectly well for you, I am happy for you. I wouldn't know how I fit within that, but it doesn't matter. If you listen and I am able to help you, I'm happy with you, happy for that. We're happy together. I like that. I'm not going to be anything else than who I am. I'm not going to fit into some mold or say what I'm supposed to say. I wouldn't be able to handle that. And no one has any responsibility to listen. So, who am I? And what does that have to do with you? And does it have to be defined? Is a definition useful? Well, let's start with me. Is my defining me useful for me? Do I become different according to my own definition, or am I simply who I am and I'm just recognizing that and becoming more aware of that? As people say, if you don't define yourself, others will define you for you. But as far as I've seen, everybody's busy defining everybody else all the time anyway. So I'll just go on being me. But if I need you to see me in a certain way, I can't do that. Think about that. If I need you to see me in a specifically defined way. I cannot be free to be me. So we start to understand the implications of freedom. We start to see the implications of being stuck in something. And I'm telling you, this is a bigger problem than you can imagine. I guarantee you, every one of you who are here in these little boxes, not really in boxes, but these Zoom boxes, feel the same way about yourselves. And I know that others feel this way too, especially the older ones who are in spiritual life. They very deeply feel this way. So now we're coming to a definition of sadhu. People who know, have experienced, have been there and done that, and who can share who they are and why. And in the forest, usually the sadhus are older and they all have these beards and they're all these very saintly personalities who are just not having to be anything to anybody. They just are who they are, divine people. So if somebody was to, you know, hear this lecture, it's a lecture, okay, and at the end say, well, what was the point of all that? You started off with all these very fundamental, basic, you know, building blocks of spirituality, and you ended up with this like vapor at the end. You started off speaking about all these great saintly personalities who we should go to the ends of the earth to follow and all this stuff, and you ended up with just this something there, all this divine beings who are undefined. Well, what did you expect from me? Did you honestly think I was going to give a lecture and tell you how everything was perfect in that, you know, system that we don't actually talk about here? Well, yeah, I did talk about it, and it is perfect in its own sense, but to understand it and understand its purpose for you as an individual was the point of this talk. And I think that had some value, because the whole thing ended up with you. It's not like, you know, I'm going to say, okay, that's it, bye, and everybody's going to stand up and go, yeah, you, yay, you. No, they're going to stay up, hey, us, me. Now, I do understand this is a, this depends completely and totally on your experience as an individual and your capacity to accept and embrace yourself as that individual divine being you are. And if you have, of course you have, but and if you have listened to things that I have said over the many years I've been saying it now, you will see this is the entire point. To give you permission, to give you the tools, to give you the way beyond the obstacles, to give you that clarity so that you can chart your own path to your realization of self and the divinity within. So I guess you can read the first thing there in Russian. Okay, just for the sake of English speakers, I will read it in English. Sorry for all you who already heard it in Russian. The way you put it seems to me that you've been describing what a contactee does. He or she has to be attuned to the atmosphere or even to the environment of how and where the other side, the guide, for instance, just to be able to translate it. And then again, just as you say, the more a contactee has an experience of what the other side, I'm just reading the thing without editing the English, of what the other side is transmitting through this contact, the more relevant and transparent the translation of this message is. It is not so much about some standards as it is about the personal ability of those two sides of connection to find their ways of contacting, coming to the relevant terms of communication. And I personally think that in the institutes where they give you an education in some foreign languages, they usually have it in their program of learning about the culture of the native speaker so that the translator could share the experience to the extent it is possible for he or she personally of the background of what is there behind the language codes. And yes, I think that when you speak of language and you speak in terms of codes, that's a very significant thing, because encoding a message in a context that tunes to the personalities who are going to receive the message is half of the effort of saying something comprehensible. And therefore, the fact that there are individuals who are making that kind of attempt is the significant factor. Exactly what I said in the lecture, and I agree with this completely. I've had professors in college that they're lazy. They simply handed you a book and said, here, read these 50 pages. That's not teaching. That's kind of like cheating. It seems that college professors are not really attuned to teaching students. Now, some of them are. Don't get me wrong. I'm not on a rampage against college professors. But if you're simply going to say, here, read that, and that's supposed to be the lesson, that's useless. And there are many professors, especially from America, okay, who might go to a foreign country and will give the same exact kind of talk as if they were in Boston, for example. You've got to adapt what you're saying to whoever it is receiving it. That's one of the basic principles of education. Let's see here. There's no numbers anymore. You see, Sati had this system of numbers. She did a really good job. She put a number in it, then I just have to tell Maha, number three. But now it's not like that. So, Maha, read in Russian the one that starts with in our time. And also, Janmajaya has been writing questions, and I don't see them in English, by the way. Yeah, read the capital letters down below. Oh, wait a minute. Are you saying that the capital letters are translating Janamajaya? I missed that. Sorry. Okay. I'm a little slow right now. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. Thank you. So the questions that are, so I'm having a hard time reading. Okay. Well, I'll read it anyway. Who am I to edit? I will read it for the English speakers. I'm just reading what is sent to me. In our time, the concept of guru is quite sophisticated, and also the concepts of sadhu. These concepts are often used with not very needed intentions. Yes, extra things that come along with it. Yes, I agree with that. Can such concepts, I think that's referring to the intentions, slow down the development of a person? These concepts more often suppress rather than inspire to be yourself. Yes, I agree with that. That when other things are involved within this predefined understanding of what is a guru, our being vaulted forward, or our being expanded forward in our individuality, is to a large extent suppressed. Yes, I agree with that. So here's a question. Can the Lord, when I read the Holy Scriptures with the hope of His mercy, reveal to me the divine space? Yeah, that's an interesting question. In Russian also, does the Russian start with, can the Lord? Okay, can. Well, obviously, the Lord can everything. You could put, can the Lord anything? Yes. So sure, you read the scriptures. With the hope of His mercy, reveal to me the divine space. Sure. I'd like to remind you of what you might remember. We had this lesson. How do you have a conversation with the deities? If you remember, you say hello, you listen, and you respond, and you listen. Conversation, right? So if you are reading about the divine spaces, let's say, the Dhamma, just let's use that as an example. You're reading, and the Dhamma, you're reading about the Dhamma. Theoretically, you could allow yourself to listen, not just listen, but to the listening analog of the feeling, of the experience. Let's dissect that last statement a little bit. So you are wishing to initiate a conversation with the deity. And your most important role in that is to listen. Nothing else is there. Listen. No mind, no analysis, no expectation, not even an effort. Just to listen. You allow your empty space to be filled. Wrong word, filled. To be entered into, to be permeated with the response. Now, when you're doing this with the deity, it's rather easy, or easier, because deities are right there. Their power is unmistakable. That's why I started this off by saying, theoretically. Okay, an analog of that situation in relationship to reading means now, instead of the sound, it's not even sound in that sense, but instead of the message, it's the space. That space of divine Dhamma. This is way harder because you don't have the unmistakable massive energy of the deities to fill you. Many people want to do that, let's say, in Vrindavan or Mayapur. But the problem is that within that space that you are physically in, there's also all this other stuff that's not related to that particular space that you want to connect to. So if you're reading the Shastra, it's totally different. It's not like you can be fully immersed, because you have to read the words. The brain has to translate the words. And once the concept is fully presented, each sentence or paragraph, you have to assemble the feeling. But if you can understand like when you wish to have a conversation with the deity. That space of emptiness, of expectation, of listening, of potential. It's a potential, a very significant potential. You've got really a significant key. So if you have that key and you use it to open that space, the potential is there to enter into it. That is spiritual mysticism at its core. If you can do that, that's great. Maha, your sound is too low, everybody says. Oh, yeah, there you are. Hi. Yeah. Okay, there's no more questions, which is fine by me because where we just ended was fine by me. Well, you know, it's like a journey. It's like sometimes to get where you want to go, you got to go through places that you wouldn't ordinarily want to go through. But when you do it, it's really worth it. So I wish you well, much love, much inner development, much ecstasy. Bye for now. Till next time.